Thanks for joining us on Rabbiting On. This is Dan the producer. I just wanted to let you know at the top of the show that because of the subject matter we deal with in this episode, there are some graphic descriptions related to the Holocaust. So if you're staying with us, do what you need to do to feel safe. Thanks for listening.
In the midst of World War II, in hiding, a young Jewish woman wrote this. The good news is that you don't know how great you can be, how much you can love, what you can accomplish, and what your potential is. And she wrote, as long as this exists, this sunshine and this cloudless sky, and as long as I can enjoy it, how can I be sad? That young woman was Anne Frank, whose diary was first published 75 years ago in 1947, has become one of the greatest books of our age. This weekend marks 70 years since the work was first published in English for the UK and US markets. Since then, it's been translated into more than 70 languages and sold over 30 million copies. You are listening to Rabbiting On. I'm Rabbi Miriam Berger, and I'm here with Rabbi Robin Ashwastein and the chief executive of the Anne Frank Trust, Tim Robertson. Really lovely to meet you, Tim.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, Miriam.
And lovely to have you back, Robin. We missed you last week.
Thanks. So good to be back and for such a great and important conversation. Looking forward to it.
We've a lot to talk about, but before we get into it, we also just wanted to send our love to Rabbi Debbie, who isn't with us today because she is in fact in Poland on the March of the Living. And of course, earlier this week, it has been Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. And for Jewish communities around the world, this is so much part of our narrative at this time of year. So Debbie's kindly been able to share some of her experiences with us, and we'll hear that a little later as our conversation continues, as she's pre-recorded little bits for us for today. But let's really dive into our conversation about Anne Frank, about the diary. Tim, I'd really love to know what you think, you know, somebody's diary has to offer, you know, all these years later in a very different world. What inspires you each day by this book to do the job that you do?
So what we do at the Anne Frank Trust UK is we take Anne Frank's diary into schools all around the country and use it to empower young people aged 10 to 15 to recognise all forms of prejudice and to speak out and challenge those forms of prejudice. So we start with the story of anti-Semitism and then we make it relevant to all forms of prejudice. And I think that the particular power of Anne Frank's diary is that it is, as it were, both tragic and triumphant. It's clearly tragic and it's on one level an absolutely heartbreaking read as this remarkable young woman, we know she has no future, you know, we know that she has no future in her own life. And her life was cruelly cut short, one of the 6 million. And she achieved everything she set out to achieve in that book. It is the great example of how we can change the world by telling a story. And I think that more than anybody else, what Frank did was brought the Jewish experience of the Holocaust to a non-Jewish worldwide audience by, above all, being a human being. But I think in a way, the question we also have to recognize is why, if you go to the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, wonderfully curated, has a brilliant sort of sequence at the end about the sort of, you know, what the impact of Anne Frank's life and work have been. And there's a film showing all kinds of different people commenting on different angles about what they've got from the diary. There's one Holocaust survivor who says, I don't like Anne Frank. She's the pin-up girl for the Holocaust. And I really get why. For many survivors, families of survivors, second, third generation survivors, my faith tradition is as a Quaker, but in all faith traditions, every person is a valuable soul, are they not? Each one of those 6 million is equally a wonderful human being whose life was destroyed. The reason Anne Frank stands out can't just be because she was a very beautiful young woman and she lived in a pretty house and it's become a museum. It's actually because she was a genius as a writer. She just wrote a better book than anybody else. It's not that hundreds of thousands of other people didn't write diaries and other books at the time during Nazi occupation and afterwards about the Holocaust. But some people, and we all know this is one of the ways in which God isn't fair. We have talents. You know, some people have talents in some things. I want to be a poet. My poems are just not that good. I'm just never going to make it. But I have talents in other ways. We all have talents in some ways. So of course we do. But it's by far the greatest book written by a teenager in the world of literature. And for taking it into schools to teach about prejudice, the story of Anne and her story in the Holocaust is the absolute bring home reminder of how serious and grave the issue of prejudice and discrimination is. It can lead to genocide. And that makes our young people take their role as Anne Frank ambassadors really seriously. And it's resistance to oppression, isn't it? Brilliant, brilliant resistance to oppression. And it couldn't save Anne's own life, but reach millions so that they would understand her and others.
I'm fascinated by the resentment piece that, you know, she doesn't tell all of our stories. One of the things I'm really struck by is her positivity, right? The quotes that we so often come back to are filled with positivity. And I wonder if sometimes that is grating, that actually so many people tell their story with horror. You know, it's the Ziggy Shipper is one of the survivors. I just can't hear enough his story because he always pictures it as, I'm going to tell you my story about being the luckiest man in the world because of all of these things that happened to me. And, you know, you expect the story of any survivor to be one of, this is the horrific trauma that I experienced in my life. And yet what weaves through the diary and some of our survivors' stories is that overwhelming sense of positivity.
Miriam, I think the passage you're referring to is from the 15th of July, 1945, and it is where Anne says, I still believe, comma, in spite of everything, comma, people are truly good at heart. And of course, it begs a question, knowing well, you know, would she still have said that as she was dying in the most appalling circumstances of disease and starvation in Bergen-Belsen, sort of 8-9 months later? We don't know, although we do know that when she did see one of her old school friends there, she was still talking about the diary and how much it meant to her. So we knew that she still believed in that as something of her that could still reach the world. I think because we exist in rather a quote culture and a tweet culture, and we tend to pick bits out of the diary, out of context. That passage in which that occurs is perhaps the greatest diary entry. And the sentence itself has, in spite of everything. No, this is not, she's not a naive writer, Frank. She writes in the same paragraph, she says, the thunder is approaching that one day will destroy us too. The remarkable thing, that's her greatness, is she is able to see both the bleakness and the terror and the horror and be hopeful and believe in life and humanity. And great writers are people who can capture that range. And there are lots of passages in the diary. There are passages in the diary where she has great fun. There are passages in the diary, you know, there's the wonderful love story at the heart of it where she falls in love with Peter, who is, you know, the only other teenage boy there. So although she also, of course, had sexual feelings towards girls, which she writes about very explicitly. But, you know, but the love story with Peter is, I think, absolutely, in a way, the heart of it. It was the bit that mattered greatly to her. Of course it does to teenagers, to all of us, of course. But that's what she was robbed of, isn't it? That was the future love life and family that she was robbed, you know, and it's wonderfully, wonderfully done. And there are passages of absolute despair and bleakness. But I still believe that sentence, I still believe in spite of everything that people are truly good at heart. I think that is the nub of her philosophy. And I think that's, in a way, the nub of what we do in anti-prejudice education at the Anne Frank Trust, is we say, you mustn't discriminate against people because everybody that there's goodness in everybody.
And get to the nub of why. Why does discrimination rear its head? You know, people are not born into discriminating against one or the other. One has to understand the journey to get to discrimination. Robin, do you have like a go-to passage?
Yeah, well, I have to say, actually, Tim, it's exactly the passage you referred to. We have it in our machs or our prayer book for Yom Kippur in the afternoon, that whole passage. And we read it every year. It's optional, but I always read it. But I've used it in countless different places. I've used it at funerals. I used it heavily at the beginning of the pandemic, because I think it's the piece that, as you said, enables us to access, allow and name any pain and trauma and still have hope through that. And I think that that's quite countercultural. We're good at like suppressing the pain, or meaning that that means we can't believe in goodness and hope because it's so despairing. And I remember saying at the beginning of the pandemic, if Anne Frank can say this, then I can find within it what I need, because I trust that she went through it all. I think it's really powerful how you explained that the pull of her work being the trauma and the triumph, the both of those together. And I think that, like, as a young Jewish girl reading her book, really, and it's a journal, right? So I wrote a journal when I was a teenager as well. So I in her writing, you know, the ups and downs of love, the frustrations with parents, whatever it is, it's just connects really deeply, and the humanity deep within each of us, you connect straight to it. And I remember I went to the amazing museum in Amsterdam as well when I was a teenager with my mum, and it was very interesting going into that, because I went in and became very angry. Really angry at what had happened, and, you know, activist, what I could do. And my mum could only weep. She walked around just floods of tears. And it was kind of a generational response. And what I was so interested in with the Anne Frank Trust videos, you've got some great videos up and that we watched. I think it's called We All Matter. I think that was the one I watched. And the young people talking in that were phenomenal, and their reactions to the book and how they were able to express very deep truths about activism, anti-prejudice, and the scourge of anti-Semitism itself and wider racisms was phenomenal. And I think Anne Frank speaks to all of that. So that is the passage that I always go to, is that, you know, the ever-approaching thunder, the world being turned into wilderness. That's almost like, for me, the Torah distilled into a passage. That's what it is. We live in a world that is wilderness. Now with Ukraine, it's the same, you know, not exactly the same, obviously, but the threads of the hatred and massacres and sexual violence, whatever it is, are there. The approaching thunder, the ever-approaching thunder, it's just completely timeless. So really, that's the passage, Miriam.
Well, it's interesting, because your kind of summation that is Torah is, for me, that, because the other piece of Torah is our relationship with God. And one of the real challenges, you know, as a rabbi trying to give Judaism to my community, is that the Torah doesn't give us an easy relationship with God at all. And often is the thing that kind of puts us off a relationship with God, because with God so personified in the way that Torah and our liturgy then takes us into. You know, I have a lot of members that end up kind of feeling like they have to admit to me that, you know, maybe they're really atheist at heart, because they really can't get to grips with God, even though Judaism is so important and actually prayer is so important, but kind of it's God that's so hard. And so for me, there's a beautiful piece that she says, people who have a religion should be glad, for not everyone has the gift of believing in heavenly things. And it's a reminder for me. For me, God, belief has always come very naturally and very easily. And it's almost as if she's reminding me that it's actually a gift. I shouldn't take that for granted, that it's just made that aspect of feeling that sort of sense of support so much easier. You know, our Psalms, I'm thinking particularly of Psalm 121, like Esayanai, tells us, when you're looking for help, when you're in need, kind of look up to the hills, look up and ask where your help will come from. And that idea that it's a gift, and the idea that she says, you know, don't look down at what's going on in the streets of Amsterdam. Look up at the blue sky, because that's the constant. And so holding those pieces for me is almost the kind of, she teaches me an important lesson in religion, in relationship with God.
Yeah. Her mother, who she had a very difficult relationship with while in hiding, brought her prayer book in, and Anna said, don't know why, she's commented on, but I don't know why she brought that in, and comes to appreciate it more as their hiding time progresses. But she's been through a particular time of doubt and depression when she comes through to those statements about religion and about nature. And of course, she could only look up because they just got some cracks between the blinds. They could see the sky and a bit of a horse chestnut tree outside. But I think it's really fascinating in the passage that you use with your young people for Yom HaShoah, Robin, that passage, which is a brilliant. I mean, it's almost a Shakespeare speech the way it could be analyzed. But the turning point between the despair and is the phrase, and yet, comma, when I look up at the sky, comma, da 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 da. And I think that's partly nature and it's partly God. I really feel that.
Yeah.
Here at the Anne Frank Trust, here is a 1947 first edition of the Diary of Anne Frank, which in Dutch was called the After House, the house at the back. So it's published originally in Dutch, and the 75th anniversary falls on the 25th of June. And then 5 years later in 1952 was the English translation, for which Otto Frank, Anne's father, chose the title together with the publisher of A Diary of a Young Girl. So the title changed.
It is extraordinary how quickly it got out into the world.
Yeah,
it really is. It was actually a bit of a slow burn here in Britain, but there was a famous review in the New York Times by one of their serious reviewers who then went on to write the Broadway play that appeared a couple of years later. And that article really was what really got it noticed in America. The Broadway play, then the Hollywood film in 1959, the house opened to the public in 1960. So it just kind of span from then. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I'll often hear people say, well, of course, Otto was brilliant at how he edited it and how he presented it. And it's, you know, which he undoubtedly was an amazing man, Otto Frank. He was wise and big-hearted enough to publish a book which was, you know, pretty personal about some of his family. I mean, it was an amazing thing to do. And there's a kind of, often here I hear a line of, it's a remarkable book for such a young writer. And I just want to say, this is a remarkable book for anybody of any age.
Right.
It mm-hmm. really is. Yeah. But I think it became the kind of trailblazer for Holocaust education and remembrance. You know, it was too difficult for nearly everybody to look at the painful facts at that point in the 50s and 60s through to the 70s, really. But Anne Frank's diary was a palatable way of approaching the topic. And it's often said in Holocaust education, when young people particularly encounter the Holocaust, we want them to develop empathy, not trauma. And I think Anne Frank's diary helps that.
It's interesting because I suspect Debbie, like the two of us, probably were given Anne Frank's diary at a rather young age to read and be introduced to. And it's interesting that this year, Rabbi Debbie has had to do the sort of the extreme, how do you commemorate Yom HaShoah, by actually being there on the ground for the March of the Living. And I believe she's got a little message for us that we're going to introduce at this moment.
Hello to my rabbiting on friends. I am here in Poland on the March of the Living and just wanted to share a couple of thoughts. I cannot possibly summarise everything that I've seen in the last 3 days and the crazy emotional journey that has been going on. But I've been thinking a lot about the theme of this year's March of the Living, which is passing the torch. And this is really about how we continue to tell these stories and share these testimonies in a world with fewer and fewer survivors. And I went to a site today where Jews were, and Poles actually, were executed in the woods after digging their own graves. They were shot into them. And this is a story that I actually grew up with because it's what happened to my maternal grandmother's cousins and uncle and aunt. And I was thinking a lot about how young I was when I knew those stories, and that I don't want my children to know those stories as young. Even though I don't think it's impacted me particularly negatively, there's a sense of protecting this next generation. But I also think they're more aware of anti-Semitism than I was, or certainly are more likely to experience anti-Semitism than I ever did. And I think how we handle that truth and that fear for them is really delicate and tricky. And I've also been introduced to a story that I wasn't aware of righteous Gentiles called the Ulmer family, who rescued Jews. This is them, their six children. You can see a pregnant mama and dad. And they actually hid a number of Jews, but were discovered. And in Poland, it was the only place in Nazi-occupied Europe where if you hid Jews, you would be executed. So the Jews were executed first when they were discovered, and then the parents, the Ulmer parents, were executed. And then they kind of apparently had a debate about what to do with the children, and decided that they might have trouble from them later on if they didn't sort them out then. So they executed the six children as well. And just thinking about the risks that people took to look after one another, you know, people who they knew locally, who they lived with, sometimes people they didn't know, and whether we would do as much and could do as much with less risk. And there's just lots of food for thought in that. I'm wishing I was with you, and yeah, lots and lots to reflect on from this week. It's a very powerful trip and journey, and one that I think is really important. I think it's also really important for non-Jews to come on this trip and experience these things. I've become very aware on this trip of how poor the knowledge beyond the Jewish community is. At Heathrow, I was asked where I was going as part of a slight security problem that was caused. A story for another time. And I said I was going on March of the Living. They asked, what's that? I said, it's a tour of Holocaust sites. What's the Holocaust? And, you know, the fact that someone in the UK today wouldn't know what the Holocaust is, an adult, you know, it was kind of astonishing. So lots of work to do.
Oh, my gosh. It's hard to know even where to begin with that, isn't it? There's so much in there. What I first of all see is just how tired Debbie sounds. And I think she's been kind of messaging a little bit, and the immensity of even me, us, hearing the story that she just shared of those righteous Gentiles is affecting me, and she's there on the ground, is so difficult. I, you know, it kind of brings, Tim, the work you do at the Trust really to the forefront, doesn't it, of people not knowing what the Holocaust is, of this. I mean, I guess it's interesting, this kind of the dichotomy of, we've got, you know, we've all got Jewish kids, the three of us, and like there's the protection aspect of what that looks like, and how do we pass these stories without it being so traumatic, but also so that it's in there, they know what it is. But then to the other extreme of non-Jewish kids who don't know anything about it, who need to understand what happened, and that kind of complex threads really of Holocaust education. And how you use Anne Frank in that. I'm kind of bowled over by what she said, really. There's a lot of process even in what she just said.
There really is. I think for me, I was struck by Debbie's, you know, who's to say we would have behaved so well if we'd been there. And I'm always conscious when in a lot of Holocaust education, we talk about being an upstander, not a bystander. And so in the Anne Frank story, we all want to, if we're not the Franks, we really want to associate ourselves. We want to relate to the helpers, right? Miep Gies, and there was Otto Frank's secretary, and there were four Christian helpers who brought the food and things to the family in hiding for all that time. We also try to remind our students, you know, we should also think about how much we might relate to the two volunteer Dutch people who came with the SS officer when on the day of the arrest. So there were Dutch volunteers who volunteered to help round up Jews and get them into the camps. And I, for me, For me, almost the most important thing to learn out of the Holocaust is that the vast majority of people went along with it, or actively or tacitly supported it in Germany and many of the occupied countries like Holland, and that there is prejudice in all of us.
Yeah,
you know, it's the complexity bit, isn't it? It's that, yes, Anne Frank's right. There's goodness in all of us, and we're all prejudiced in different ways, and we mustn't. We need to be careful that the Holocaust history doesn't become something that teaches that's what terrible, nasty, extremist people over there like Hitler do. Of course, we're not like that. We're okay. We're the good people. We are the good people, but goodness always comes with the mix, and we always need to be examining our own prejudices. And stories are the way, above all, I think, to do that.
Is there also something in the fact that, am I right in remembering that the Franks moved from Germany, they fled Germany to be in Amsterdam? Their first fleeing was actually where they thought they were then going to be safe until Nazi occupation spread wider. And that idea, you know, whilst people are fleeing Ukraine at the moment and going to neighbouring countries, that actually we have a responsibility to make sure that people only need to flee once, that actually what they're fleeing from is contained, and that this war does not spread, and that people find themselves having thought that they had escaped and thought that they had got to safety, when actually the violence and wickedness in the world is actually the thing that continues to spread and follow them. You know, I think whilst people are fleeing and still feeling in hiding, that it isn't just a sort of a prejudice piece. It's a how do we keep people safe? Because that idea, we were meant to be doing a baby blessing for a new baby that had been born in Ukraine this last week, and her parents had, you know, moved to a different part of Ukraine to be safe, and then couldn't be on Zoom with us because they were down in the bomb shelters. And you just think, you know, what does it mean when there are still people in hiding in the world? We sadly don't need to look too far back to know that we have a responsibility in the here and now.
Completely right.
I mean, I think that speaks to the timelessness of, well, the particularity of Anne Frank's writing, and also the universality. Like, it speaks to where we're at now. And Tim, I'm really struck by what you said. And it's funny, I was reading, I have lots of Rabbi Lionel Blue, Zichron Olivracha, Britain's best loved rabbi, as he was known, lots of his little quotations. And I happened to pick a book of his up today, as I often do. And he said in it, I resolve, and he did a list of things. One was like not to eat my dog's chocolate biscuits and things. But then one of them was, with his usual humour, one was I resolve to remember the little Nazi inside of me. And I think there is something that links in with the timelessness of, we all have the tendency of violence and hatred and prejudice is within every human being. Also the tendency to goodness and to love and to activism, and to remember that and work hard at it. And that's the timelessness, and that's the call to action that Miriam gave us as well, to really hold on to that. And I think partly also for me, to remember the depth of Anne Frank in that as well, and who she was. You spoke about her being a pinup, you know, being seen sometimes as a pinup girl. And I read a really interesting article in the Jewish Renaissance magazine about how Japan has taken on Anne Frank as a symbol of the Holocaust. And there's anime versions of her with big eyes and beautiful. Yeah. And it's fascinating how she can be appropriated and beautified in that. And we lose actually the depth of her writing, but also the horrors of it. So just that kind of reminder, it's really important for me. It's really helpful to be alongside the trauma, to see it within my own self, but also that call to action of moving forward. And I think having seen those videos of the young people speaking in your video, there was one little boy who said, I know I've had stereotypes and I'm now challenging those. And I was like, wow, your work here is done. Like, well, that's it, isn't it? For each of us to recognize we have that, and therefore we're doing something about it. So powerful.
A really beautiful way to end, Robin, and maybe finishing with the words of Anne herself, who said, how wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. If we just keep self-checking and hearing those calls to action, then maybe we can truly appreciate her legacy and hope that it continues not just in reading of her diary, but also in our actions that we take away. Tim, a huge thank you for you joining us today. It's been so interesting to hear from you. And I don't know anyone that knows a book as well as you do that hasn't actually written it themselves. I love that you can quote word by word and even know what date they're written. Is really
Not all of it, Miriam, I should emphasise, but still.
I just assumed that if you can do it with one or two, you can do it the whole book. It really, really quite amazing.
It's just wonderful to connect with you, and it really is, and to see Anne Frank's life and work continuing to mean so much. Thank you.
Yeah, and I just want to also say, like, I think it's really gorgeous that you're here and you're a Quaker, and the amazing work the Quakers did during the Holocaust as well, that real understanding of that, putting values into action, and the fact that you're continuing that as well, and this kind of sense of us being together in an interfaith moment as well of holding it. Yep. I just think it's gorgeous. So thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you. If you would like to drop us a line after anything you've heard today, and we hope that it has resonated with many of you, do make sure you use the email address media@rjuk.org. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. And believe it or not, we're rather proud to be celebrating a whole year of Rabbiting On. In that time, we've built a bit of a gang, and we hope that you'll continue to join us as we celebrate, look back over the year, and start thinking about topics we want to engage with in the future. A year of three rabbis, a guest now and again, doing what rabbis do best, rabbiting on. Until then, lovely to be able to chat to you all.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Rabbiting on. Rabbiting
on. Rabbiting on. Three rabbis, you and the fat, a little bit of this.